This is Thrive Perspectives, an ever-growing discussion about the issues and ideas that shape our lives with your guide, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Good morning, Connell. Good morning, Matt. Thank you for the coffee again, Connell. You do our regular Saturday morning coffee runs and we appreciate it, mate.
So. It's my most important job, isn't it, really?
Well, you know, that was why we invited you to the conversation, of course, because you go past the coffee shop.
I know.
Morning, Matt.
Yeah, what do we got, Stu?
Well, welcome, listeners. Great to have you back with us on Thrive Perspectives. And we thought with this episode, we'd sort of pick up a bit of a conversation following on from our previous episode, where we were sort of talking about McGilchrist's work in relation to left brain, right brain thinking and the way we process things, and try to unpack that a bit in terms of what does that mean, you know, without going into, you know, step one, step two, step three, but just perhaps it was a little easy for us to sort of fall into this, well, that all sounds good, but what does it mean for me? And I think it'd be good, Matt, for us to perhaps just
just reminding listeners.
Yeah,
and,
great.
And this is carrying on from the last episode. So yeah, it might be good to, if you haven't heard that one, to totally go back to that one. But let me just remind listeners. So the prompter for this was, you know, for this conversation was the work of psychiatrist and philosopher Ian McGilchrist, who's wrote a very famous book now called The Master and His Emissary. And he's written recently another big book called The Matter with Things. But I'd probably, if people are interested, actually, there's a shorter book. I know it's available on Kindle. I read on my iPad. So
no way,
through the Kindle app as an ebook. It's called The Divided Brain and the Search for Meaning. And I think you can get it for like $2 or $3. It's very short. So it's a great short summary. Or even if you know, just jump on YouTube or listen to a conversation on a podcast somewhere with Ian McGilchrist.
I'll put the link at the end.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep. And I think it is, it's not only do I think it's important, but I do think it's a bit of a game changer in the sense that he is focusing on the way that the brain processes reality. And, you know, he sums up all of this research, sort of replacing old views of the left and the right brain. You know, basically, he says that left and right brain are both involved in the way that we process reality, but they process reality in different ways. So the right brain, in a sense, processes reality in its wholeness, in its continuity. It's the big picture. It's the explorational aspect of the brain, you know, taking in new experiences. But in a sense, and this is the illustration of the master and his emissary, the way that it's meant to be is that the right brain is the master, you know, it takes in the experiences and it sort of hands it to the emissary, the left part of the brain, which then does the analytical stuff, right? Left part of the brain is the part of the brain that breaks it into pieces, that segments things, that tries to understand things. And I've got a quote here that might be helpful. He says, for in humans, it turns out that the hemispheres pay different types of attention to the world, reach out a hand towards it in a different way or with a different set of priorities and values to grasp and take it for our own use or to forge a connection and explore. So to grasp and take for our own use is the left part of the brain. To forge a connection and explore is the right part of the brain. Now, you can read this stuff and there are ways in which they can discover this sort of stuff and through, because you can effectively sort of shut down halves of the brain and it's all, that's really, really interesting. But for our purposes, that analytical part of the brain essentially deals with a closed system. It focuses, so it takes reality in chunks and it analyzes it in, you know, into bits, which is somewhat artificial, right? Because, you know, reality, the world is one continuous thing, right? It's a oneness in a sense. Everything is sort of connected. But
an example we used last week just to help listeners with that was music. If you listen to a piece of music, that's one thing. If you then try to pull it apart into crotchets and quavers and
that's right,
all the mathematical stuff, it's no longer a piece of music.
And so you essentially you lose the meaning or the wholeness of the thing.
Spot on.
You know, which is a continuous sort of flow. And in a sense, you know, language, for example, tends to be a left hemisphere thing, because it's by that way that we divide the world up and we name things. And this is, you know, I mean, this is a wonderful part of the way that God has created us. And by the way, McGilchrist is not advocating a materialist view of consciousness or mind. He doesn't think that the brain generates consciousness like those that believe that essentially a materialist worldview is that there's only physical stuff and that's all, you know, there's nothing more. He actually believes that he identifies three different views about mind or consciousness. One view is that the mind emits consciousness in the sense that it creates consciousness. The second view is the view that the mind transmits consciousness. So consciousness is bigger than the mind, but it transmits. He nuances that with the view that he talks about the brain, not the brain emitting consciousness, not the brain even transmitting consciousness he's okay with that view, but I think he believes, based on the research of the way that the brain works, is that it permits consciousness in certain, so focuses consciousness in certain elements.
Shut that out.
Yeah.
Keep the same.
And I think in our everyday experience, and this is moving towards, because we want to move towards a practical application of this, it focuses our attention. Now, when I walk down the street, I naturally pay attention to certain things, and we tend to pay attention to things that are of most concern, you know. So when you're crossing the road, you're paying attention to the traffic, right? Now, now there are lots of other things around, and you do sort of take in that other stuff, but it's in what's the word?
Subconscious.
Yeah, in a sort of subconscious way. But, you know, reality, and this is his point, reality tends to narrow itself down to what we attend to. You know, it's
what we focus on.
It's
or
what we focus on. Yeah. So that's, and in fact, he goes so far as to say, and this is another quote here, he says, "The kind of attention we bring to bear on the world changes the nature of the world we attend to. Attention changes what kind of thing comes into being for us. In that way, it changes the world." Now, what he means by this is not that we change the world in a sense, but the kind of attention that we bring to bear on the world changes, in a sense, the value of things, because we naturally prioritize certain things. And so certain things come to the fore and other things fall into the background, right? And other things we don't notice at all, depending. Yeah. Now, he thinks, in a sense, the brain functions this way. And so he's essentially, what he's saying, the master and his emissary, is the issue that he has with, and it's a bit of cultural critique, because essentially what he's saying is that we have developed a culture that has made the emissary into the master. So what has happened, he believes, is that we're overly preoccupied with grasping and analyzing and instrumentalizing the world. Now, he says, grasping and analyzing and instrumentalizing, that's a valid thing to do, right?
We need to do that to some degree.
That's right. We need to do that to some degree. But in a sense, that all needs to be in the service of the right brain. It's in a sense, so you know, reality is fed through the right brain. It's handed to the emissary, does its analytical business. What can I?
What's important for the other side to know?
That's right. And then it hands it back to the right brain, because the right brain essentially gives everything meaning, right? Yeah. But we've sort of, you know, we've moved away from things to do with meaning and value and in our culture, and move very much towards instrumentalizing the way. How can I instrumentalize my environment, other people? How can I instrumentalize reality in a way that brings me pleasure and happiness?
So instrumentalize means really use it as a tool to serve me.
That's right.
You know, to create.
That's right.
Use it to serve my purpose.
And that's, you know, and so, because in a sense, we can actually, and the point that he makes is, our cultural environment can favor a certain working, of the brain, and the culture in which we grow up, that we grow up in, it creates certain pathways in the brain. I mean, the work of Jonathan Haidt also reflects a lot of this sort of stuff, you know, because he talks about how, you know, the ways in which we develop as human beings, in a sense, shapes, you know, the brain has this plasticity. In a sense, we shape. Even the brain is shaped by our cultural, you know, by our cultural environment. And I mean, I've been reading Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation, which is I think it's like absolute vital reading, because he talks about the way that a certain kind of like a play-based childhood helps to wire the brain. And we've moved from a play-based childhood to a screen-based childhood, you know, and he talks about how that is rewiring, you know, the brains of young people. And so anyway, that's another topic. But the point is that we can actually, by the things that we attend to and by the cultural environment that we're in, and even the upbringing in that cultural environment, it can actually, in a sense, rewire the brain in such a way that we favor. And what he's doing is that he's saying that we have so favored the left brain, analytical thinking, instrumentalist thinking, that that has become the master, right? So that they're, you know, so that the right brain, in a sense, is being suppressed. So that this kind of sort of cultural psychosis.
Yeah.
And listen, the reason why I just loved this stuff is because it helped to explain something that not only that I have seen in my own life, yeah, right, yeah, as a classic overthinker, mm, right? And see, the thing is, because the left brain works in a closed circuit system, it's like a computer, not connected to the internet. Yeah. You know, it can only work in a, I don't know if this is the right illustration, but yeah, it works within a closed circuit system, right? And so it creates this feedback loop, right? And you can, and you've only got logic to work with, and you can only analyze things and break things down. You can't sort of reach into the whole of reality. You can only break it, you know.
We can only deal with what's known.
That's right.
There's a whole lot of other things.
And that what's grasped, known in the sense of grasp, yeah, logically.
And useful to us to generate some kind of outcome.
Yeah.
You know, so it's got to have, I think that's the idea of the left brain, is that you kind of can take an idea and reduce it down into some kind of instrument or tool that allows us to focus and grab hold of something.
Yeah.
That's the thing that we need to grab hold of.
Yeah.
And of course, the result of that is it's a narrowing because we're only able to deal with the things that have been fed to the left brain.
Yeah.
Probably from the right brain itself. Yeah. So the left brain becomes knowledgeable with a whole lot of different things, but it's only really interested in the things that it can control, and then it narrows it down, and then it becomes arrogant, and then with that sense of focus, it tries to manipulate things to its advantage, including people. So people become less about having an inherent value. Their value then becomes more about what can I get out of this person, you know, that becomes goal focused and so on. So, and McGilchrist isn't a Christian, but he's pointing to, he's very clear that he thinks that because we've become so left brain dominant as a society, especially over the recent, you know, I guess it's the last 100, 200 years, as we've really elevated science as the way, the really the only valid way to know anything at all. As we've become like that in society, all those attributes of pure left brain thinking is what we've inherited. And so he actually is quite pessimistic about the future of the world unless we can readdress this balance, because we're on this destructive path where we're going to destroy ourselves because the left brain's not designed to be the master.
Before we jump into the detail here, I just want to give a really low level example of you know, when you say what we attend to and the attention we give to things. So probably many of us go out for a walk, and the idea of our intent of going out for a walk is just to kind of relax a bit. But I wonder how many of us go for a walk, we get home and we've solved a whole lot of problems, but we've never heard the birds. We've never noticed
that's
the sunshine.
A great example.
We've never heard the wind blowing through the trees because we're just, our left brain is just busy trying to solve problems in the space we've tried to create to actually be in right brain space.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And because it is it becomes almost a bit obsessive. And it's interesting, you made the interesting comment because he talks about this a lot, the inherent arrogance of the left brain, right? Because it closes reality down and it thinks it knows everything. And so any suggestion that it doesn't, it sort of almost has this tantrum, and they actually see this in people with right brain strokes and so forth, where people operating only with left brain, they just cannot. There's certain aspects of reality they just cannot acknowledge, and almost becomes frustrated with everyone. Anyway, people can read that for themselves. But the interesting thing is, you know, I mean, essentially, this is where I think this is such a game changer for things like apologetics. And because essentially, he's saying that sort of scientistic, you know, kind of that new atheism, essentially, it's like a left brain tantrum.
Anything that's saying, prove it.
Prove it
to me, you know.
I'm not going to, until you offer rational empirical proof, I'm not going to accept that it's real. And you know, McGilchrist, as well, I may say, as
many,
you know, most like I think contemporary philosophers. I mean, that's a big statement, but there's a big swing against that because it's just like, but that is that itself is irrational to you know that yeah. that idea. I think that's a great example, Stu, because you know what I have discovered in myself, and I think in conversations with people, is that we so easily get stuck in this feedback. It's like this echo chamber, right? And, you know, McGilchrist uses the illustration of being in a hall of mirrors where we just see the reflection of ourselves all the time. And you can't get out. You don't see out of reality. Everything's just inward facing. Mm-hmm. And so it's this, you know, it's those times when I think back where I've gone out to try to pray somewhere. And my brain is just going, is God really there? Is this real? Is this real? Is this real? Is God really there? And maybe I've gone to pray about something, but my brain is just trying to fix it. You know, just trying to, you know, and it's like there's this feedback loop that you get, you know, sort of trapped in. And I think for me, it was the breakthrough was recognizing that this is this kind of pathological situation of this echo chamber. It actually, you know, when you bring things into the light, it's the first step. You know, when you bring deception into the light, it's the first step of, you know, breaking those deceptions down. And I think just initially just to know that, okay, my brain wants to close reality down. It wants to instrumentalize the world. This almost like this kind of God complex, you know, that feeds this left brain kind of becoming the master thing.
Yeah.
And that wants to instrumentalize, classic God complex, right? So we've all got this. To actually be able to say, no, I'm going to make a decision here to not let that happen. And instead of trying to think my way out of the feedback loop, which you can't do, right?
No, that's right.
You just, because it's more of the same problem, you know, and it just goes faster then, right?
But I think the left brain is clever enough to fool us to think that we have solved the problem or can solve the problem.
Exactly.
So we get to a point and go, oh, that's it.
Yeah,
and that just reaffirms. Thinking.
It needs to retain control.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And again, so we are not saying that thinking or logic or thinking things through, common sense. I mean, common sense is an interesting concept because I think that's more right brain. That's how everything sort of connects.
Yeah.
But there's certainly a role here. But the thing is that reality needs to be governed by the big picture of what is meaningful and valuable, right? Of us looking at reality through the lens of God's hierarchy of value. You know, some things are sacred, like persons are sacred, right?
Yeah.
You know, an ability to look at even the world and not just see stuff, but actually have that sense of wonder.
And that's what's happening. When you listen to McGilchrist talking, this is where he ends up. It's not just purely academic, that if we can then tap into right brain, then we can perform better at our jobs and so on, even though there's is an aspect to that. But where it's leading him is into them with thinking of things from a right brain perspective, is that the right brain is actually designed to plug into a different sense of reality than just the immediate physical reality that we deal with, you know, day by day, which is where most of our attention goes.
Yeah. Would you say different sense of reality or bigger sense of reality? Because I think it's important that there isn't two separate realities.
No, there's not. Yeah. But because of our left brain, we only give attention to the obvious bit that we can grasp and there's an intuitive knowledge, and we're not completely, I don't think any of us are without that. We kind of have to suppress I think we've been taught to suppress our intuitive knowledge because it's almost like, well, it comes back to, if you can't prove it, you know, anything that can't be proven isn't really all that valuable as a form of knowledge. That's kind of been the mantra of society.
Well, certainly Western culture, I would say.
In the last lot of years.
Yeah, I think it's a cultural thing that shaped us this way. Because you can go to places still probably today, I haven't been for a little while, but, you know, places like Fiji, and everyone talks about Fiji time, where the priorities are seeming completely different. You know, money isn't the driver. People is. Family is.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's very much a consumerist Western cultural thing
we think we're smart enough.
Yeah.
To not have to deal with fairy tales and mythology, but just to deal with what we can control and what we can analyze and what we can prove. And I guess over the last 10 years, especially like with that whole sort of rise of like new atheism, it's kind of been pitched to us that really that's the safeguard of society is that we just ground ourselves in what's demonstrably proven to be true and everything else is dangerous.
Yeah.
I think we've all bought into that in some way.
Totally.
You know, because we kind of think, well, there's a certain amount of sense behind that line of reasoning. But the issue is, and this is, you're listening to McGilchrist talk, he talks a lot about the sacred and the divine.
Yeah.
And this is where he's kind of coming, there's something else beyond what the left brain perceives, and it's what the right brain is able to plug into some kind of awareness of understanding and connecting to and relating to something that isn't explicitly knowable to us, but it is implicitly knowable. Yeah. I mean, I'm sort of kind of putting into my words what I think he's talking about there, and that's really stuck with me.
Yeah.
Because that's completely countercultural to how I've kind of thought about.
Yeah.
Even though I do like ponder the big questions, and obviously I'm a Christian and I have a relationship with God and so on. So you'd think, well, you'd think you'd know that. But I think everything is so tarnished with this left brain thinking that it actually cripples, not cripples, but reduces my idea of God.
Confines it.
Yeah. And I think listening to, and it's not just McGilchrist saying it, I'm just seeing there's a change in atheists who are talking. I mean, we mentioned in the last episode, I think I said that, you know, Dawkins come out and identifies now as a cultural Christian. And, you know, and people have been talking about, what does he mean by this? You know, that's crazy for him to even to want to identify with anything of that sort of language. But what he's saying is, we're starting to see there's something of value in at least believing the Christian narrative. And we see people like, you know, Tom Hollands and other people, I think, who are contributing to the conversation, even people like, you know, Jordan Peterson, who's out there talking a lot about this sacred kind of stuff. Yeah. And as if there's something else that we were missing out on.
Mm.
And I think, you know, for me, it's like kind of getting to the point where I kind of think of it as almost getting permission for myself to allow myself to explore that implicit knowledge.
And to legitimate
exploration of it. Yeah. Because, you know, when we talk about, you know, you've got to pray and you've got to contemplate and so on in order better ways to try to understand God, it's still very process orientated as if I've got to do something. But I think the thing that I've been sort of missing there is a sense of, well, I'm doing it because I'm a person of faith. And so those things are maybe a way for me to try to tap in and get closer to God. But it's actually sort of poo-hooed really if you're not that kind of person, because it's not a very good way to live your life, because you're just living in fairy tales, you're just trying to invent things in your minds and so on. So, but what they're actually saying now is that shift in thinking, saying, actually, there is something of value here.
Mm.
Which doesn't mean to say we believe in God, but there is something of value, and there does seem to be something beyond just what our left brain has told us reality is.
You can't close reality down.
You can't. These are not people advocating any kind of faith necessarily, but saying, I think we've missed something.
Yeah, they're identifying a problem with how we are thinking in a sense. And, you know, I mean, looking at this as, you know, for me, looking at this from a Christian point of view, it's essentially And I think I see this again and again. I mean, this is the interesting thing about philosophy and reading philosophy. I mean, it is constantly very self-critical, and philosophers do tend to eventually recognize the inconsistencies in their own thinking. And so there was already conversation around this within philosophy. Like, you just can't narrow reality down that much. You can't close it off. That was the interesting thing, that this that was already very much, you know, recognized. And then, of course, you know, I mean, the interesting thing, of course, is with McGilchrist, is that he comes along and he says, well, this is actually kind of pathology, like a brain pathology that is involved in this. And then you've got, you know, the work of the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, who, you know, talks about the flattening of reality and how we're wired for this, you know, our well-being. I mean, he's talking a lot about positive psychology and what are the elements, or at least one part of his work is, and, you know, what do we need for our general well-being? And he recognizes we're wired for spirituality. wired for another dimension that our culture has flattened out. And so in lots of different directions, we're recognizing a problem. I guess it's okay. Well, what do we do now?
Let me just make one comment, because I think it's an important comment to make. And I, you know, just referring back to what Connor was saying before about even amongst atheist thinkers, philosophers, whatever they may be, there's a sense of there's value in this. I think it's important to say, as Christians, it's not just another idea that we think there's value in. As Christians, we know there's reality in this.
Yeah, that's right.
There's not just value. It's not just another kind of way of thinking that's going to make us better, you know. This is part of the Christian faith's reality that we've known potentially for 2,000, 4,000, whatever years, science, psychologists are catching up to. So I think it's important that they may be couching it as like, oh, this is another way of thinking that'll make you better. We're actually saying, no, actually, this is not just another way of thinking. This is actually
reality. So the contrast to that is, it is. That's a good point, because we think of things of value as what we can get out of it.
Yes.
Where I think right brain thinking is more about what do we value is actually not knowing. Mm. You know, like McGilchrist actually talks about what the right brain gives us is a sense of awe and wonder.
Yeah. Mm.
And you can see how that's beneficial.
Mm.
And you can see how you lose that as soon as you reduce everything down to break it all down into its parts. So it just becomes a machine. Awe and wonder is what comes from the right brain. Mm. So, and from awe and wonder involves not knowing things.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of like this permission there to not know things and sit and be prepared to sit in the not knowing and not trying to understand, you know, which is the opposite to how I've worked, because I'm always thinking, how does that work? What does this mean? You know, and it goes on and on.
As you said before, I reckon even not just be prepared to, but enjoy sitting in the unknown and the unseen and the awe and the wonder.
And that's actually, according to the thinking that McGilchrist has done, that is actually more important. That is where we're actually meant to be from a right brain perspective. Mm. So all the other stuff is subservient to that, which is complete opposite of what we've been told.
I would add another sort of obstacle. It's funny, you know, because when we shouldn't be surprised, there are obstacles to us knowing God, like, you know what I mean? Like these sort of internal obstacles that we have created. And, you know, it's this idea of deception. And, you know, we know that there are spiritual forces of evil, you know, trying to deceive us and, you know, and by all means, you know, shut God out. But I'd probably add to this, because I mean, I read recently Justin Brierley's book called This The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And, you know, he talks about this return to, you know, belief in God. Now, the thing is, and a lot of what comes out of this sort of work is people are more open now to, oh, actually, we really need to reconsider this. And, you know, McGilchrist is a kind of theist. I say a kind of theist, you know. And I'm seeing a lot of this, even, you know, we've talked about the return to mind-based views of reality and you know, even philosophers like Thomas Nagel, let's see something like the Greek idea of the logos, you know, that we see in John 1:1, in the beginning was the logos. You know, John draws that Greek idea of there being mind, the mind of God present in everything. And there's a real return in philosophy of this idea, the presence of mind in all things, you know. And so a lot of people are very compelled by these sort of mind-based views of reality now. And that's connected with quantum field theory and all sorts of things. Anyway, my point is, right, that a lot of people are, in a sense, more open to being open or knowing that there is a God in a sense, like that's just your starting block. It's not because there's still an obstacle there at that point. I mean, Paul says in Romans chapter 1, although they knew God, they neither worshipped him as God nor gave thanks to him, right? So, you know, I mean, Paul doesn't give a lot of credit to people for just believing. He said, well, you know,
well,
I mean,
it was almost,
I mean, the devil believes in God. I mean,
but it was more, much more, it was almost looked down on back in those societies that if you didn't believe in God.
Yeah.
Like you were the odd one out.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
Well, there wasn't. I mean, in a sense, in the ancient world, there was no atheism as we know it. So we've, you know, okay, yes, we've gone further behind in sort of in that sense. But here's the thing, and this is going back to previous episodes that we did where we described a more multidimensional reality in terms of a double axis, you know, horizontal line intersected with a vertical line. The horizontal line stood for, I guess, that one dimensional way of living, you know, between pleasure and pain. There's no aspect of reality. As soon as you open reality up, particularly in a theistic sense, you know, you get this axis from the sacred to the profane, right? That means as soon as you enter meaning and value, you allow for that, you open up reality to allow for a transcendent sense of meaning and value. You realize some things are actually sacred. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, all of our values are in our culture. This is, of course, what Tom Holland keeps pointing out, that all of our value system is based on this double axis. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't use those terms, but it's based on essentially the Christian framework, Christian worldview, right?
Yeah.
The thing is that vertical axis, you know, the sacred to the profane, there is actually a resistance in us to accessing that experientially, because the moment you access that, you allow for the fact that we have fallen to the bottom of the vertical axis, right? And this is, I think, for me, again and again and again, the point of access to the whole eternal reality of God and who God is, and is, in a sense, it's always going to be blocked by my unwillingness to recognize how I have taken something sacred and desecrated it, right? It desecrate. And that doesn't mean that what I have desecrated ceases to become sacred. It's desecrated because it's sacred.
Yeah.
And so this essentially is what sin is. Sin is taking something sacred and desecrating it. And the experience at the bottom of the vertical axis is the experience of shame.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one of the most painful. I mean, it's literally, I would say it literally is the shame and the guilt that we feel at the bottom of that is literally hell. And because of that, we tend to block that out. This is what, you know, as in that previous episode talked about, you know, how Freud in the sort of at the beginnings of sort of modern psychology is seeing patients who are struggling with this repressed guilt, you know, and his answer was, well, we'll just get rid of that whole aspect of reality that makes you feel guilty, right? There's nothing wrong with that, right?
Yeah.
Which essentially meant that he had to deny that there was a sacred profane axis, you know, and the loss of that in our culture. And this is what Jonathan Haidt talks about, the loss of that, you know, we lose that axis to our detriment.
You don't even lose it, but you remap it onto somewhere on the other axis, which is between pleasure and pain.
Yeah,
so we actually lose the ability to understand what even sin is, because sin is then just somewhere on the line between pleasure and pain. It's what causes pain, and
which is a classic left brain thing to do. We'll just put it in a dimensionality that we can break down and instrumentalize,
and we still feel the impacts of that, but we don't know what it is.
Yeah,
because we can have all the pleasure in life, but still feel completely in conflict.
Yeah,
and not know why.
Yeah,
because we're still feeling the effects of
It doesn't go away because it's
it doesn't
part of
go
who
away.
We are.
It's still there. We just had to. We've only really got two things to think about: does it cause pleasure or pain? That's the only.
And so, what happens? And to connect that with this, you know, left right brain sort of stuff is that. And actually, I think we can do this as Christians too, where we think, okay, what can I do to get rid of this bad feeling and create a good feeling, right?
Yeah.
It's the idea of how can I do something that makes me happy, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so we try to do things. It's this classic way of instrumentalizing things. And in a sense, you know, it's the same it's the same sort of thinking that says, well, you know, I'll go and meet with people for worship on a Sunday morning if I feel like it. You know, well, I didn't get much out of that. Or does it, you know, does it, it's that classic left brain. Is it, can I instrumentalize this in a way that's useful to me in my life? Whereas we should be doing that because it's sacred, right? It's like, a, you know, because it's stepping out of that and stepping into something sacred and something that allows us to transcend ourselves and our little instrumentalist universe over which we're trying to play God. And so getting back to, you know, what I was saying, for us to open up our reality and say, well, there is a God, we actually have to recognize that there are ways in which we have fallen short. And this is why we hold the cross to be central, because it's through Jesus actually that we can deal, that we can, this is, you know, the doorway to accessing in a relational sense, the fullness of reality is at the bottom of that vertical axis where we see the ways in which we have fallen short. And I'm not saying as Christians we need to just continually wallow in all the ways that we've failed, but I know that life is about salvation. Like, I have been saved, so I recognize I am reconciled with God, right, once and for all. But there's also a sense I am being saved, right? And there's this process in which I need to keep coming back to recognize ways in which I fall short, because it, in that way, I again and again I meet Jesus. I overcome, therefore, the obstacle that blinds me or shuts me out in a sense. And so I have this continual, you know, point of access. It's not like it's at one point I'm like, oh yeah, I had these dealings with Jesus back when I first became a Christian, but I left that behind. No, I'm constantly through the cross. I find this point of access to God. I always say to, you know, because some, you know, there are some people say, oh no, I believe in God. It's just all the Jesus stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't need to be all that Christian stuff. No, no. Unless you have Jesus, all you have is a vague idea of God out there somewhere. And yes, we are wired for that, but you're always going to be pushing that away. There's something within you that's going to be pushing that away.
It's helpful to feel that you are pushing that away. One of the things I was thinking about listening to different commentators talking about this and this kind of opening awareness, even with atheists, of there being something divine or sacred or something unknowable out there, without putting any real more definition around it than that, is that I was kind of thinking, well, does that then create a new kind of nominalism? Mm-hmm. Like, as if we discover that and then do nothing with it.
Yeah.
And so...
And you know, and then we get into wonder and music, and we start, you know, we go through a sort of a little bit like, you know, in the 19th century, the sort of romantic mood where everyone was into being spiritual.
Yeah.
But it was sort of in a general,
And you were happy with that, going, well, we don't know about it. Like true agnosticism almost, going, there's something, it's not knowable, but we'll just enjoy
and
it.
And we are in danger of, I think the... Yeah. I see a lot of that in response to a lot of this stuff, you know, and it's a problem, right? Because you're exactly right. It deals with a kind of, it becomes a kind of nominalism. But again, to really ground this, for me, you know, we're talking about, you know, how the left brain does this thing. We get locked in feedback loops, and I think the beginning is to take responsibility for this. It's not like we're passive victims of something.
Yeah, that's right.
We do this because we have this sort of God complex, because we want to be in control. Yeah. Like we ourselves are doing this. Like it's our way. There's a motivated thing. It's something about the human heart. And for me, when I feel myself doing this, I go to confession. It's like, Lord, I'm sorry. I'm trying to pull, Lord, save. It's this, you know, whoever calls on the name of Jesus will be saved, right? So if you can't get out of the feedback loop, that would suggest that you need a savior, right? Yeah. Like, let's get down to the, you know, to the real basic stuff here. Jesus saves us from our sin. I mean, and I'm wanting to, it's always good to take responsibility. You can't change what you don't take responsibility for.
Yes.
And just saying, oh, I'm a passive victim. Oh, this is just the way that our, you know, our brains are culturally. And no, we actually need to take responsibility for that. And it's not even enough just to try and then jump to cultivating different habits. And sometimes in response to the McGilchrist stuff, in sort of secular, oh, well, we'll go for more walks in nature, and we'll go to more classical concerts, and
we'll sit, I mean, meditate.
It's great. Like, do that, right? Yes. Do more. Like, but it's not going to solve the fundamental problem. The doorway is for us to take responsibility, say, no, actually, there's a motivated empowerment here. It's me that's instrumentalizing reality and instrumentalizing other people. It's not your brain isn't something else. You're not the victim to your brain. Right? And, you know, people say things like, oh, I just, my thoughts kept running away from me and I tried to pray, but my mind, you know, my mind kept going. And it's like, okay, well, if your mind is, who are you? You know, and I think taking responsibility for that. And so for me, it's recognizing that, say, Lord, will you help me to get out of this? And already there, I'm reaching outside of that, right? And you know, and then there's a decision to make. Once you recognize it, take responsibility, then I think we can start to actually do things that connect us with God. It's not just about reaching into, you know, some impersonal spiritual reality. It's connecting with the person of God. It's connecting. It's reaching out that hand.
Yeah.
And that can begin with because often what I do, instead of just trying to overthink, it's the acknowledgement, Lord, I acknowledge that you are here. You are present here.
Yeah.
I give thanks to you for who it's, you know, confession, it's thanksgiving. It's these basic elements of prayer. At some point, you've got to stop thinking. You've got to stop the feedback loop and actually do something, right?
Yeah.
Now, God started the conversation already. And so, you know, it's that action of take responsibility, acknowledge God, give thanks and so forth. This is the way.
Look, after we recorded the last perspectives, you know, it's got me thinking and studying.
Is that a good thing?
Left and right. not usually. Because I'm always in the feedback loop.
Yeah.
I'm always thinking it over, thinking, what does this really mean? How do we connect this? Trying to connect all the dots, trying to come up with something. And the thing that I've kind of been thinking about was the left and the right brain and how left brain is becoming aware of the fact that I'm so left brain dominant in my thinking. And then, well, that's actually how I approach God most of the time, you know. And I've just become a lot more conscious of it. And then kind of thinking, well, what does the right brain experience of God like really look like? And I've had them. And I've had times where, you know, God blows your mind and so on and you can't explain it and so on. But most of my time, 99% of my Christian journey is sort of rooted in left brain thinking.
Yeah.
And it's that constant feedback loop of always trying to understand. So like after we did the last one, I kept thinking about it, thinking, what does it mean for me? It's great theory, but how does that actually practically, you know, sort of play out? And it was actually, the next day, and I was actually out, I was mowing the grass, and I was listening to some podcasts on a similar thing, and then they came to an end as well. And I'm kind of thinking about it a bit more. And then my sense was, I'm always trying to know God in the sense of know him, as in have knowledge of, that I understand.
Yeah.
And so as I was going through, just pushing the mower up and down, I was kind of thinking, well, what if I just stop trying to have that knowledge or trying to understand?
Like analytical knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as I'm just sort of outside, there's a sense of God just being in everything, like being present and conscious and, you know, like when I think of God, I think of a person up there, you know, even though I know it's not true, but that's how my mind tends to want to think of God. But what if I just let go of that and just allow God to be completely around me in everything, through everything, in a way that is so far beyond anything that I could ever possibly comprehend at any level?
Yeah.
If that's who God is, the only way I can really approach him is to let him sort of be that. And what does that kind of look like? And as I was doing that, the words that were coming into my brain was thinking to God, who are you? You know, there was a sense of like Adam and Eve in the garden, you know, when God was sort of looking for them and going, where are you?
Yeah.
He knew where they were. Yeah. I know who God is.
Yeah.
But there was a deeper sense of God, who are you? Who are you? Like you must, it's just awe and wonder.
Yeah.
You know, not just a person in the sky, but who are you?
Well, and it's the same. It's the same for me to get to know you. It's not just, you know, I can do a scientific dissection and analyze your blood type and analyze every set, but that's not knowing you, right? Because some people say, oh, if only God were a discrete object that I could look at and see and sit before me, then you know, I feel like that would help me to know God. You know, again, that's classic left brain. The left brain wants something that it can grasp. But we don't even know each other like that, right? Because we're not just physical objects. We're minds, we're persons, right? And persons, you get to know a person it's a kind of spiritual engagement where it's a relational thing. Mm. You enter a conversation, and to know God is to enter the conversation, which begins, because remember, God has started the conversation. So it begins with us listening and paying attention to what God has already said, you know, which is why we read the Bible, right? This is God has already spoken to us.
Yeah.
Okay, God, what are you now saying to me? It's attending to what God is saying to us, attending to what God is saying to me, and responding and giving thanks and confessing. And because essentially the life-changing thing for me here with all of this is that it has unearthed a deception, right? And whenever it's like, oh, you know, that feedback loop, I've been deceiving myself. There is always deception at work somewhere in us, you know, and the process of growth in our faith and our spiritual growth is a lot about unearthing the areas in which we're essentially self-deceived. Mm. The devil's always at work trying to deceive us in some ways, right? So the way that you disempower deception is to bring it out in the light. So for me, this is where this has been so life-changing, because now I think, oh, hang on, I'm doing this. Mm. I'm doing this feedback loop thing. And this is what I mean. You know, when I confess it, when I take responsibility for that, this is something that I'm doing. Lord, help me. Lord, you know, save me from this. And then already I'm connecting with what God has already said, because He is and He's available. And it means that, like, the recognition of that becomes the launching place for me to reach out to God.
But I think it's also just letting go. It's almost like just trying to just be in who God is without trying to understand. And where I'm asking that question, like, who are you really? Mm. You know, like, you revealed yourself through scripture and so on, and that gives us a way to be able to understand and approach you. Mm. But you're obviously so much more than that, than what we can ever understand. So in asking that question of who are you, I'm kind of allowing myself to sort of redefine that, not leaving that behind, but it's like broadening my understanding of it into a sense of awe and wonder, because so often I don't have awe and wonder in God because I've reduced Him down to something that I can sort of understand and control in a way and so on. So
you're doing there is asking a question.
Yes.
Which I think is great, because that's part of the opening.
Yeah.
Lord, who are you? Show me who you are.
Yeah. And so, but at a really sort of deep, there was a really deep level of it. I just felt like this presence of God just suddenly surround me, and I'm pushing the lawnmower.
That's great.
And I thought, I'll just turn it off. And I just went somewhere, and I just thought, I just want to stand. Mm. I just have to stop what I'm doing. And just, there was this just sense of just something sort of enveloping me and going, this is who I am. Don't try to understand me.
Yeah. Mm.
And the other thing that came out of it was, you know, when you listen to McGilchrist talking, he talks about this kind of deity, the divine, and so on. But, you know, as Christians, we've got another aspect to this. Like, who are you? We don't really know. It's beyond our comprehension. But what we do know is that He's personal and He knows who I am.
Mm.
He's not some sort of distant divine force. He knows who I am, and not just knows who I am, but actually loves me and also wants to draw closer to me in a way that, you know, any friend or relationship is even beyond my knowing.
Yeah,
that's who He is. So we have access to that divine. They talk about the consciousness in the universe and the cosmic deities and so on. And you can kind of grab hold of that in terms of sense of going, like, who are you, God? That's just incredible to think that you are kind of that, but you're more important. You're actually personable and you draw near and you love us.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that we get when we're a Christian is understanding that. That's incredible. And we should have awe and wonder in that. And so what that's probably done a little bit there is change me. I start every day thinking, God, who are you?
Yeah.
There's that I can hear those words in my head.
Yeah.
It's like, who are you?
Yeah.
Reground myself with that.
That's
sense
right. Because he wants to, you know, God wants us to connect with him personally and to know him, you know, to know God is everything. And it's a relational thing, you know, and we have access to God and to knowing God through Jesus, who of course is the ultimate expression of who God is. But it's not just a knowing something about Jesus is enough. I think that's a wonderful question because it invites God to reveal himself and to, you know, we place ourselves in that, what we've described as a contemplative frame, which is being receptive and to allow that space and that openness for God to not only reveal himself for us, but even for us to know ourselves in him. And it's the beginning of all wisdom.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Thrive Perspectives. Our hope is that these discussions will challenge you to look at life from a new perspective. You'll find all our resources at the Thrive Today website, thrivetoday.tv. If there's a topic that you'd like us to discuss, please email us. Our email is contact@thrivetoday.tv. Until next time, our prayer is that you will thrive.